Welcome back to Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth. And because it's Tuesday, it's time to speak with somebody smart about sports stories that go beyond the sports page. This week's guest is someone I've wanted as a guest before I even had a podcast. It's independent filmmaker Sean Pamplin. Now, you might know Sean as the director of the excellent ESPN documentary, Run Ricky Run, which is probably the most intimate portrait of a professional athlete and maybe of a person, period, that you're ever going to see on television. Sean's also famous, or infamous, depending on your perspective, for releasing the audio of former New Orleans Saints defensive coach Greg Williams, exhorting his players to, quote-unquote, kill the head of concussed opponents. Now, Sean's newest film is the just-released United States of Football, very well reviewed, by the way, and it's excellent. I've seen it. I recommend that all of you see it. The film starts with a simple question. It's a personal question for Sean. Should my son play the sport? And from there, it ends up exploring everything, from the terrible toll football takes on former players like Kyle Turley, to why football has such a powerful hold on our national psyche. Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Well, that was awesome. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Hope did I leave you speechless?
Well, I mean, I was going to say, if I was related to you blood-wise, I mean, I don't think you could have said something nicer. That's fantastic.
Well, let's start with the news. The big news, late last week, the NFL and the more than 4,000 former players who were suing the league announced a tentative settlement to the much-publicized concussion cases. And just for people that aren't totally familiar, the league was accused of minimizing and covering up the acute and long-term health risks of football-induced brain damage, which has led to some very tragic outcomes for many of the men who have played this game. A quick breakdown of the settlement, again, if you've missed the news or just want a refresher, it's going to cost the NFL roughly $750 million. Most of that money is earmarked for testing and treatment for suffering former players who figure to get help sooner rather than have to wait through a protracted litigation process. So they had incentive on their side to settle. Meanwhile, the NFL is not going to have to admit any fault or wrongdoing. In fact, they don't even have to admit that playing football led to any of the brain injuries that will be eligible for compensation. Nor does the NFL have to worry about disclosing the full extent of what it knew and didn't know, and when it knew information about the risks of playing football. Sean, I wrote last week in reaction to this that this settlement could be good for these former players and their families who need that help sooner rather than later, because there are some people out there that are suffering really bad right now. But I also wrote that it's definitely good for the league, because for basically less than 10% of their yearly revenue, they get to wash their hands of what had been an ongoing slow motion public relations disaster. But let me ask you, what do you think of the settlement, and what do the former players you talk to think of the settlement?
Well, I am personally very conflicted about the settlement, just from the fact that, like yourself, I've been exposed to a lot of former players who are in trouble. You know, their families that are you know, relatively destitute, and who still have mounting medical bills with potentially no end in sight. So, on that level, I was happy for people to have some immediate relief because I know the stress level they live under. Mm-hmm. But the other part of me was very discouraged, because we need to know how the sausage was made. You know, when the tobacco lawsuits were settled, it was understood, okay, we can't advertise on television anymore because we can't hook children in. We don't have Joe Camel anymore. But what, you know, there have been a lot of correlations to me between the tobacco industry and football over the last few years. You know, people I've talked to, like Frank DeFord, like Congresswoman Linda Sanchez. Mm-hmm. My response is always that football, I smoked cigarettes for 13 years, and cigarettes taste like shit. Football tastes like ice cream. So to make the correlation at many levels is off, because as consumers, we love it so much. And I look at this and I say to myself that we needed to know what's going on. We needed to know exactly what you were talking about, when they knew what they're hiding, if for no other reason that they are so ardently selling this game to our children.
Right. Well, they are selling also. They're not just selling the game in terms of advertisements, or there's been, you can find this on YouTube, there's an NFL cartoon that was put out Which is that would be worth its own podcast. It's so ridiculous.
Oh, the one where Drew Brees goes to Canton and they all the kids they fight off the evil forces that are looking to end football. That one.
That's right. I'm not surprised that you and I aren't drawn in as part of those evil forces. But
Well, I mean the whole thing with Brees. I mean, to me, it's this is sad because you have to. I believe that modern football players, pro football players, because of what has been disclosed, they have to tell us whether or not that they would let their kids play football. They have to. They have to share. Like, how can you sell a game to the American public and you're not willing that you wouldn't allow for your own kids to play?
I feel the same way about NFL executives. I'd like to know, Roger Goodell has daughters. I guess he's okay. But I'd like to know, Jeff Pasch, these other lawyers that run the NFL. I'd like to talk to all the owners of the NFL. I'd like to see a poll of every NFL owner. Would you let your sons, or in this case, maybe a lot of them, your grandsons play?
Yeah, like transparency, like how many politicians actually who voted for these wars, how many politicians have their children in harm's way?
Right, or these politicians that vote against, for the 50th time, they vote against Obamacare because they don't want socialized medicine. Meanwhile, they're covered by the Congressional Medical Plan, which is like the best socialized medicine in America. I like to know these things. I'm with you on this. Like, we
I
should have.
really
We
need
need
to
a
see.
full. We need an NFL full disclosure form.
I mean, it's so ridiculous that we can almost laugh a little bit, but I think that you and I need to laugh because we've been exposed to so many of the devastating aspects of this. And if you don't try to blow off some steam on it, you could just literally go crazy wrapping your head around all this stuff.
It is. You're right. I mean, it's devastating. It's depressing to, I'm not the one suffering, but spending enough time with the people who are, is enough. But well, let me go back to something you just said, where the part of you that's disappointed that really wants this, the truth to come out. What did the NFL know? When did they know it? What are they hiding? Now, the players don't have to necessarily agree to the settlement. Any of them, now or in the future, can strike out on their own and file a lawsuit. And this is America, you can always file another lawsuit. But, as the mediator made pretty clear in their press release, if they try to continue with or bring individual suits against the league, it's going to be so much more expensive and so much harder to win. Do you think we'll see any players actually try to do that? And if so, why or why not?
Well, my actual hope is, and I consider myself a player advocate, not just a storyteller or a journalist. Yeah, I've taken these people into my heart, and I really root for them to have what is fair and what is just. My hope is that there's at least one or two guys who, are on this suit because of the righteous nature of it, because they were not given the proper information to make educated decisions. My hope is that a few of these people who are doing really well in life, who don't need this money, this cash infusion right now, will opt out because we need to have the discovery. We need this information. And to not have it divulged, I think it does, like I said, it does the players a disservice, but it also does the American public a disservice because we are letting our kids play this game because we are celebrating it on such a level. And I think that there's somewhat of a cultural willful blindness as it relates to this game, and I'm one of them. I mean, I freely admit that I'm gonna have my Russell Wilson jersey on next Sunday. I'm excited for the season to start, and but I just want these guys to be taken care of fairly, and I don't want people to be lied to about what we're actually watching.
You talk about willful blindness, and it's sort of like I like that term a lot. But also, I wonder, do you feel like with football in any way that our cultural, this is something you explore in the movie, our cultural attitude toward the game and its dangers and its risks, and maybe not wanting to know the extent of those and not wanting to know how the sausage is made. Is there any parallel there between that and sort of our use of energy and the idea of climate change?
Well, in the film, actually, one of the comments made by our colleague Michael Silver, who's a good friend of mine, he says, "Listen, we know this is. I'm not going to have a global warming debate. We know this is happening, and I think that we do know it's happening. I think that the coverage itself at times can be very daunting. I mean, I know that you were on Outside the Lines this morning. This is a show that has covered this issue for quite a while. But when you put Outside the Lines in an arena that also has NFL Live, NFL 32, NFL Insiders, NFL Countdown, and if you put it in a platform that has like 30 shows that are dedicated to extolling the virtues of football, it feels to me like cover your ass journalism, because we're gonna say that we're covering this story, and we have these really talented reporters who with great investigative skills, but when it comes down to it, we only want you to let you know to know so much, because it is in direct conflict with our cash cow.
Right.
So it just doesn't really compute. I mean, I know that Real Sports does stories now on football, but when they had Inside the NFL, I don't think you found them as being aggressive as they are now. It's just the lack of independence through this process is something that that compromises almost all of it.
Well, let me ask you another question about – well, I want to get into some of that media stuff in a minute. But while we're talking about compromising and we're talking about sort of this information about the NFL's knowledge and whether or not it'll ever come out and what that would actually mean for the league and its business interests, you know, when I wrote about the settlement, I said from the NFL's perspective, it was analogous to Goldman Sachs and how Goldman Sachs paid – what was a record $550 million fine to the Securities Exchange Commission for their actions leading into the financial crisis. Now, again, for people who don't remember this, Goldman was basically peddling these crappy, toxic, mortgage-based securities to their clients, telling them, buy this, it's a good investment. And at the very same time, the bank was betting against those securities because they knew they were crappy. They knew they were going to blow up. So Goldman was trying to offload them to get them off their books and bet against them to make even more money. It's pretty outrageous behavior for a bank.
Yes.
Now, it would be a complex case, obviously, to bring against Goldman, but there was definitely some basis there for criminal prosecution. Goldman was essentially hiding what it knew about risk from its clients, analogous to the way the NFL, to some extent, we already know, was hiding what it knew about brain damage risk from its players. The bank walked away with a fine. Nobody went to jail. It did not have to admit any wrongdoing. It just paid a toll, the cost of doing business. Let me ask you, do you think that the lawyers and the owners sitting in NFL executive suites following the settlement are looking at it and thinking, you know what, this is just the cost of doing football business?
I think they're looking at this settlement and they're ecstatic because they don't have to reveal their business. You know, I think that spreading this money out over such a long period of time, I mean, it's not even a ripple in their ocean. You know, they have to be absolutely 100% thrilled. And plus, it happened before the season started. So, you know, in the mind of the American public, regardless of whether or not anybody opts out in this suit, everybody just, you know, wipes their hands and is like, awesome. This part's behind me. We don't have to talk about that anymore. Let's talk about the football. And then what's going to happen is someone's going to get blown up on the first Sunday or the first Thursday. People are going to be like, you know, in the crowd, oh no, everybody's going to be quiet. And then we're going to talk about how this puts it all in perspective. And then we're going to drag the dude out into the tunnel. And then boom, next play. All right, we're back in the saddle. You know, it's like,
right.
It just doesn't register. It doesn't compute just because we love the game so much. That's why when I talk about these issues, I tend to focus on the children because I am a huge football fan. But like Chris Nowinski says, and oftentimes he says, you know what? We have boys playing a man's game.
And Chris Nowinski, by the way, tell people who he is and for those who don't know.
Chris Nowinski wrote the book Head Games. He's been very influential in this issue. He was part of the Boston University group that does a lot of the brain study. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been, you know, out in front of this before most people ever even heard of it. And he also experienced it himself. But as a former college football player, you know, he's and so tied into the medical community, he's really up on these issues. And he just made a salient point. He's like, you know what? Football's a man's game. And we have boys playing a man's game.
Would you almost compare it, and you say the man's game, but it's also a man's profession. I mean, it's a dangerous profession. I would say sometimes, you know, Dave Zirin, writer for The Nation, friend of mine, has often talked about all this as terms of a workplace safety issue, and he's often compared it to coal mining. And I would say that that's not a bad analogy necessarily if we're talking about men, professionals who are being paid and deserve a certain level of workplace safety and knowledge about that, and their employers certain responsibilities. But like you're saying, there's a whole other half to this is unlike you don't in coal mining, you have adults doing coal mining. You don't have high school coal mining groups. You don't have peewee coal mining. You don't have a say. Like, we don't have amateur coal. We don't have colleges sponsoring coal mines on every campus. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. We don't have the coal mining feeder system that you see. I mean, I see, PV programs all over the country that are running the same place as the high school. So they're being indoctrinated early. But yeah, we don't have the Zoolander's offspring working in the coal mine, like these guys are. It's just, but the disconnect there for people is, well, coal miners get paid like no money, and these guys made all the money, and I think because of our hero worship for these guys when they play, and then you couple that with the amount of money they make, there's just a disconnect. They cannot relate to people in helmets throwing themselves at each other like missiles. We want them, they're like video game widgets at this point. And I think that's a big thing that in the United States of football that we're trying to do is to take the helmet off them and make you realize these are people. And at the end of the day, after all the consequences of these actions, like they hurt, they're in bad shape. And I get the fact that, okay, they made the choices to play this game, but a lot of this discussion isn't about knees and elbows and any other joint that you could, or parts of your body that you could permanently injure, that you can have a limp.
Not
But
orthopedic injuries that,
exactly.
presumably somebody like a, NFL concussion guru, Elliot Pellman, who actually is not a neurologist but an orthopedist, would actually know something about and would be useful for that kind of injury.
Without a doubt, without a
That's,
doubt.
I'm
But like,
sorry, that's a sarcastic joke on my part, but.
that's a joke that on the inside you and I understand. And I hope that, I mean, you've done some great reporting on this. I hope people would actually.
Okay, for people again who don't realize, Elliot Pellman was the former New York Jets team doctor who was installed as the head of the NFL's long-serving concussion committee. The concussion committee is the committee that repeatedly put out scientific papers claiming that concussions in football are not serious injuries, and concussed players in the NFL can go back into games on the same day, and multiple concussions do not lead to long-term or not linked to long-term neurological problems. Basically, it was ground zero for all the bogus denialist science that was later discredited. But Elliot Pellman somehow is still hung around as an NFL medical advisor, which is something I've written about, something ESPN OTL has written about. And the NFL has never really been called to account nor had to answer as to why he's still on the payroll. My only guess is they'd rather have him sort of inside the tent than outside the tent, if you know what I mean. Although now there's a settlement, I wonder if he will quietly disappear over the next few years off to a land of lucrative, ironclad non-disclosure agreements. That's just my
Oh,
guess.
he's gonna be chilling in the Caymans with three honeys and two tall boys. I mean, it's please, that guy. I mean, coming on the ed, the heels of you talking about potential incarceration for some of the people in the financial industry, if there was one person, he would be on the Mount Rushmore of corruption in the NFL as it relates to this issue.
Health, the
As far,
player health.
yeah, ex exactly. As far as I'm concerned, and the fact that he stayed there all that time, I mean, it's clear, at least to anyone with a semblance of knowledge on this issue, he must know too much. I
Right.
mean, he must know too much. And the big thing I keep coming back to in this equation is transparency. Like, all these things are being covered up with NDAs. There's no transparency. How do we, Sean Mori, who's in the film, makes a great point.
I
He
tell
says,
people who Sean Mori is, very important person to know.
Sean Mori played in the NFL for the better part of a decade. He was a special teams ace for the Philadelphia Eagles, for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and for the Arizona Cardinals.
And people that don't
And
realize this, Sean Mori has a genius level IQ. He is one of the smartest people you will ever talk to.
well, if you said that to Sean, he would completely denounce that.
I
He would
know he
lie
would.
about
I
it. He'd
know he
say, no
would.
way. Yeah, because I mean, he's the person in this equation that I've met that has he's like the fountainhead, and he did exhaustive research from the medical aspect of this and also from the legal aspect of this. He created, while he was a player, He created, co-created the Mackie White Traumatic Brain Injury Committee, which was part of an important part of the National Football League Players Association. And Sean was an executive committee member, elected by his peers. He retired in the fall of 2010, probably a few months before I met him. And, he worked exhaustively to make sure that these issues were brought to the forefront. He's the reason why they got the concussion poster in the locker room. But at the same time, he's highly conflicted because he would say that he was asking players to do the thing that he couldn't do, which was take a knee. There is so much pressure involved in staying on the field and keeping, to keep your job. These contracts are not guaranteed. Imagine if you went to work tomorrow and you had this pressure on yourself, like, you just got in the American best, what is it, American Journalist Best Sports Writing, right?
Best American sports writing, but much like Sean, we don't need to blow smoke up
Well,
that.
whatever, like whatever. I'm just gonna say it was an awesome piece that you wrote about Austin Trenum. But let's say you show up, and next week you don't write as well as you did last week.
Right.
And what if there's another person over there like working that keyboard a little bit harder than you at night, and you may lose your job? You literally could have just been awesome the week earlier, but if you lose a step that quickly, you're gone. And people don't understand the pressure it is to play and to work in that kind of environment. So these guys are doing things. I mean, even though you have these lawsuits, the current players, they don't want to know. It's an occupational hazard to get too much information in this. And when Sean actually retired, some of his peer group was like, oh, he knew too much. Well, I mean, if a little knowledge is dangerous, then Sean was like a heat-seeking missile, because this guy, he got all the information. And he was almost like taking like the midnight ride of Paul Revere, and he was trying to warn people about what was going on. But so many of it, there's such cognitive dissonance on this issue that he did what he could for 3 years, and then he's like, okay, his executive committee membership is up, and he's tending to his family. But I've never met someone who fought for a cause as hard as Sean Morey did. And I think that every player who plays the game now and into the future owes him a great debt, because even if some of the things that he wanted to change didn't get changed, it put people on notice, that
What did
someone's
what are
watching
some of those things? What did he want to change that hasn't happened yet?
you. Well, if you look at the current deal with the amount of money being allocated towards research, one of the things that, I mean, it's evident this is happening, and a lot more of the money needs to be allocated towards treatment,
Right.
treatment of these a treatment of these issues. But when you put so much money towards treatment, there seems to be a bit more of an acknowledgement that this is what actually happened. Research is great. Oh, we need to know if this is really happening. We need to know if this is something that, like, we need to keep an eye on this. We need to do these 10-year studies that will confirm what a lot of people in the know already know. We just don't know the degree, and we don't know the percentage. But to deny that this is happening is ludicrous. And to come up with all these, helmet innovations and everything else that I know you know very well, and even though the public is hearing these things, it doesn't process. The better helmet technology does not help the player. It allows you to hit with impunity, and your brain suffers more.
That's true.
That's
Every expert will tell you that there's no magic concussion helmet. There will never be one. It's a simple, the simplest analogy to think of is your brain is the yolk, your skull's the eggshell. If you put Kevlar around eggshell, you can keep the shell from cracking, but the yolk will still move around if you shake it. That's what happens to your brain inside your skull, essentially, and that's where a lot of the damage comes from.
Without a doubt. And I'm telling you, Patrick, if I had $5, right, for every time a parent was talking to me about their new revolution or their shut helmet, or like, well, we did this and we got the best helmet. Okay, what is that doing? Like, Riddell got sued for the loss of their insurance because they were talking about how their helmets, 31% less concussions. Really? Like, how do you know that? I mean, 80 to 90% of these injuries are going unreported. How do you possibly know that that's the case? It's just, I mean, I feel
And
like
half of those studies about these helmets are funded by the helmet companies, so they're
thank
already
you very
shady.
much. Thank you very much. I mean, this is my whole point, is that there's this this mountain of evidence. There's this mountain of like this either anecdotal information or factual information that we can draw upon, and still, like later today, like for my follow-up to the United States of Football, I'm doing a film called Choosing Sides, right?
Okay.
And it's all about the polarity, the polarization of football on this issue. So I haven't been in a fantasy league for probably like 7 years. All right. I quit it. I just was just like, okay, I want to watch the games and like be a football fan again. But this year I'm going to be in a fantasy team with my son and his, merry band of 15-year-olds, right? So I
Okay.
got them coming over later today to draft. And like draft day for me used to be like Christmas, right? It was the best time with me and all my friends from college. But I mean, I'm not amped up for this at all, I mean, I'm only doing it because I want to shoot it and I want to understand like sort of our youth culture's take on it. Because when I was younger, I didn't care if guys got hurt. I mean, I was rooting for dudes to get knocked out in the first quarter if I was playing against them, because I wanted to win my fantasy league. I didn't think that a head injury was something. You'll be back next week. I didn't want them to get knee injuries because I didn't want them to lose their careers. But it just shows you like the mentality, and I wasn't the only one. It takes an exposure to these people. It takes exposure to their wives and their children to really understand the impact, at least for the people who are suffering. Now, let's be real. I mean, not everybody goes through this. I don't want to be
That's true.
yelling, like fire in the movie
No,
theater.
that
There
you
are
know what?
plenty of
That's
people.
an important point. There are plenty of people that come out of the game, and if they have any long-term damage, it's not mental, it's just physical. Or they don't have, or a few lucky ones don't have any long-term damage at all. So I mean, no, I think I'm glad you said that. I write a lot of critical things, but I think that's an important thing to note.
I think it's a very important point, because if you don't acknowledge that, then everybody thinks you're just being alarmist. One of the things that's amazing for me is that the reason why we're so much more aware of it now is because these guys are sharing information. These guys are all like quote unquote warriors, right? Do you think that these guys, when they're done, that they're going to call their buddies up, and be like, "Yo, man, I'm hurting so bad." You know what I mean? They
Yeah.
take pride in
I
that.
got lost driving around my neighborhood. Like I exploded my wife and kids for no reason now. No one's gonna no one nobody wants to talk about that who doesn't play football. And like you said, these guys with a football mentality especially don't want to they've been from an early age, essentially you're conditioned as a football player to hide pain. Like psychologically, that's essentially what the sport teaches you more than anything else.
It's funny,
You
like
have
a
to
few
hide it
years
from
ago.
you have to hide it from yourself before you can hide it from anybody else, right? If you're gonna
Without a doubt.
survive, you have to hide it.
Without a doubt. And even though your teammates in these locker rooms, because of the lack of guaranteed contracts, you're also scratching at each other's eyes to stay there.
Sure.
Yeah, you're teammates, but at the same time, you don't want to expose any weakness. Because you don't want anyone to know. And so you take that culture of extreme like privacy and hiding things from even the people you're closest to. You don't want to admit the worst things about your personality or the things you're ashamed of later. And they didn't understand what they were going through. Now, at least guys now
Right.
have a clue as to why they're feeling this way. I mean, my friends, Kyle and Sean, they understand when their head's pounding and they're on edge, and they don't feel like themselves, or they're experiencing violent impulses or wanting to hurt themselves. They have ways to like sort of talk themselves down in this situation because they know it's not rational,
Right.
but it's real, and the one of the difficult parts is, for a lot of people in this situation, is that, ACLs and all these other things, there's x-rays to prove it. I mean, there's brain scans, and I mean, people are getting tested in ways they hadn't before, but you can't see it. So when a lot, I get so pissed when I hear people talk about, oh, all these guys are just jumping on these lawsuits just to cash in. Well, you know what? In any class action or mass action situation, if there's money to be made, there's gonna be some people who do that.
Of course.
That's in any walk of life. But all I ask for is when someone says that, okay, you tell me the guy who's faking, because I got a whole convention of dudes I see every year, and you saw them last year,
Right.
A whole convention of
No,
dudes
it's
every year.
literally a convention. They get together in Las Vegas. It's independent retired football veterans. So
Yeah,
just so people listening know, we're not using convention as a figure of speech. It's a literal convention.
it's a real convention. Like Dave Pear and Robert Lee put on this fantastic thing every year, and these guys come and they come to learn about the lawsuits. They come to share their stories.
They talk
They
about
come to
how to
listen to.
access their pensions or what's left of their pensions or the pensions they've been screwed out of. I mean, it's all sorts of stuff like that. And actually, they do somewhat share and open up about the things they're dealing with.
Oh yeah, I mean the stuff during the day is informational, and then at night we all get together, we drink a few beers, and everybody's just talking and sharing. And I mean, in addition to the stuff they're struggling with, I mean, they do have those moments where they're talking about beating the crap out of each other, and they'll click glasses and remember this one and remember this one.
Right.
So that part of it is still there, and they're in conflict with it too, because a lot of the things that damage them are the very things that they'll talk about today in terms of like having pride because I played through it.
It's
I
what
got
define
through it.
it's literally what defines them as men. I mean, it's
Yeah.
their whole self-identity. And I don't mean to sound condescending when I say this. I mean, it's just true. This has been the sport has been an incredibly important part of their lives. It's an important part of their emotional lives. It's an important part of their formation as people, and they have reason to be proud of a lot of these accomplishments. It's not, I don't want to belittle them either. So I think you're right. The idea that there's an incredibly conflicted emotional relationship there is true.
I think that these guys, in addition to being, great football players, great athletes, there is a common thread amongst them. And I don't believe it was just generated from football. You hear, well, it builds character, builds all this, builds this. No, I think that a certain personality and a certain kind of person will be drawn to football, surely. But the people who succeed at the highest level, they have that extra that most of us don't have. They have that reserve that most of us don't have, and if they applied that energy and that extra to anything else they were doing, I think these men would be successful. Like the notion I hear, like when people talk about, oh well, what if football evaporated? I remember I read this thing last year. Well, you got to give poor people a way out.
Oh,
Really?
that's awful.
No, you got to give poor people an incentive to be successful, whatever it is. Like, people like this who are willing to put this effort forth, if they put this effort forth in anything, they would be successful. They're special individuals, and I think that we treat them that way as long as they're providing us a service.
Or
But when they
entertainment.
don't provide, yes. And when they don't provide us a service, like we just go to that place of, oh, they made their money, I don't care anymore.
Right.
And it's not, I mean, the numbers. More than half these guys are getting a minimum wage for a league. That's a lot of money. But when you put it into a 3.5 year career and you add the tax bracket and you add I mean, at that age, there is no way I could have got that amount of money, played 3.5 years, and been set up the rest of my life. Maybe I'm just not as smart as other people, but I wouldn't have been able to do it. So I empathize with a 22-year-old who's come into a bunch of cash, doesn't have a great financial acumen, has a bunch of friends who want to be around and come for the party, and you're thinking you're invincible. I'm going to last 10 years.
Right. If you
And then
don't
you wake
think
up.
that way, you probably don't make it that far in the first place.
Exactly.
You, like
You
we talked
have to
about
have.
earlier, you have to almost be somewhat, I don't even want to say self-delusional, but maybe you focus your attention on only on certain things, and that's what informs your sense of what's possible. Put it that way.
Yeah, well, I think that we talk about going, having the blinders on, right, and not
Right.
being,
That's what I mean.
avoiding distractions and everything else. The ability to have that tunnel vision. These people are special. That's part of the reason why we admire them, why they play. But when it's over, I mean, I keep coming back to this point. They're very human. And Leonard Marshall, I spent a lot of time with in the past like week or so, promoting the film and traveling. And he would come back to the same thing. He goes, What made us heroes on Sunday, now you have to realize we're human. And the way he says it, I mean, Leonard taught at Seton Hall for 6 years. He's like got an MBA. He's an incredibly sharp guy. And
Right.
just being around him, I learned so much. But just the way he was able to be soft with that, like we're human. Leonard's about 280 pounds and could wipe the floor with anybody I've seen in forever. But he's such a soft-spoken, kind-hearted gentleman that, that's been the thing that has been very rewarding for me in the process of making this film, is that I think that we're going to show you that side that will make you empathize with people that for a long time we've just ignored.
I think that's really important. I think you're right that it's somehow when these guys stop playing, we stop empathizing with them. And I don't know if we ever really did in the first place as fans. I'm not really sure. I haven't decided that. It probably depends on each person, but when I talk to people about this subject, I am sometimes blown away. Not only by the like what's I would even call it a lack of empathy. I would call it an actual hostility to the idea of almost like, how dare you feel sorry for a former football player? And we could probably spend an hour talking about why that's the case, but I wanted to ask you something a little bit different. It's one of the things I've taken away from this whole story, all the way through to the settlement and even where it's going afterwards. At the professional level, how broken and unethical NFL medicine seems to be. And I don't mean that every team trainer or doctor is a bad person or corrupt. I'm not saying they're all James Brooks from any given Sunday, but I mean the whole model is flawed. It's just a fundamental conflict of interest everywhere you look. With these concussions, you had these team doctors who are on the team payroll, or even worse, they're team doctors paying the team for the right to be the team doctor. So
Thank you
they're
very much.
right.
No one talks about
No,
that.
you're right. So their immediate financial interest, get these guys on the field ASAP and keep them on there, is not at all necessarily aligned with the player's long-term health interest. So now you end up in this last decade with all these concussed players not only getting pushed out there, but they're also being pumped full of Toradol, which is this painkiller. It's also a blood thinner. And helps you take more hits to the head. Your blood's thin. There's more brain damage, most likely. And I think going forward, that's going to actually produce even earlier, uglier brain damage problems. And I say that having talked to some scientists off the record who sort of suspect the same thing, that we're going to see worse stuff from this last generation of guys. And then meanwhile, you have all these, like we talked about, you have players in non-guaranteed contracts. They have all this incentive to stay on the field and hide or play through brain injuries. But also at the top of the pyramid, right? Like we talked about, the NFL's old concussion committee was producing a bunch of industry-funded science that came up with a bunch of coincidentally industry-friendly findings. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if any of what I just described has changed, like with or without the settlement. I see better policies in place. I see more scrutiny, but I see the same flaws. Like, team doctors, they have the same incentives. Players have the same incentives. Take bad risks. And I see the NFL now funding a lot of the same research that was once independent research. Am I worrying too much, or is all this still a big problem?
No, it's Groundhog Day, and we're seeing it. I mean, it's amazing. One of the things that I mean, every point, one of the things that is interesting to me is that we haven't heard any talk. At least I haven't. I mean, I haven't watched any preseason games, but that whole independent neurologist thing that was going on, that was announced last year in New Orleans at the Super Bowl. How many are they going to have? Are they going to have one for 106 players? Are they going to have one on each sideline? What happens if two or three guys get concussed at the same time, and then you're dealing with those guys, and then other players are getting hurt?
Well,
I haven't heard how this program's going to, how is this going to work?
yeah, the devil's in the details, and speaking of that, I talked to one person, again, a scientific expert off the record, who told me, in their estimation, that there was maybe a dozen people on the entire face of the earth, that would really be qualified to make a super accurate sideline determination of whether a player has been concussed or not.
I think you and I talked I think you and I talked to the same person, and
Probably.
what I would love is for all these people that we can't actually quote to come on the record and say what they know. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I it's great for us to be given this information, but then we can't actually say where we got it from.
It doesn't have as
And
much impact coming for you or
it
me because
doesn't
it's like, oh, you're just
exactly.
making it
It
up, you know.
doesn't. Oh, you just have an axe to grind, or like sources tell me. You know what? You know what? With the state of modern journalism, I have no problem with people thinking I'm full of shit. You know, because look what's going on around us. You know, how are we supposed to trust people? You know what I mean? I mean, how are we supposed to trust people?
Well,
I mean,
you know what?
right.
Let's get into this. Let's talk about trying to get people on the record, people not talking, people being afraid. You were trying to get Roger Goodell to talk to you for the film, and it doesn't seem like the NFL cooperated with you in any way. What was that like for you trying to get just minimum cooperation or comment from them, and also kind of basically going up against them with this film?
Well, my feeling is this, is that, in a situation like this, I mean, we want to protect kids. You know, the people I'm working with, we're sincere.
Well,
Like, we
Roger
worked on.
Goodell will come out over and over and over again at youth football clinics and claim that he's doing the same thing, and people who cover the NFL regularly will write that he's doing the same thing. Are we not supposed to believe
Yeah,
that?
well, the people who write that he's doing whatever you're talking about, oftentimes want to, they want to keep their access. I went to them as an independent journalist, okay? I had a first look agreement for this film for the first year and a half with ESPN. I was in very good standing after Run Ricky Run. They were very happy with my work. I spent about a year and a half trying to wrap my head around this issue and bring them cuts. Like I brought them three different cuts, and I was responding to direction that they wanted me to go into. Then finally, after like a year and a half, they're like, "You know what, Sean? You're pretty good at what you do. Why don't you just go do it, and then we'll look at it afterwards." And I think that,
So they sent you off the reservation.
yes, they sent me off the reservation. And then, well, once I released the Bounty Gate audio, they backed away from me fully. Like 2 weeks later, they didn't want to have it on the site that I had a first look agreement, backed away from me fully, and I basically had to hound them for 6 months to get them to even watch a cut of the film. You know, it's just, I mean,
Well,
the NFL.
why do you
I
think ESPN sort of had that reaction?
don't know. Why don't you ask PBS that? You
Let's
know, I mean.
you know what, let's get into that. As again, for people that are listening but maybe don't know, there's this PBS documentary coming out in October. It's called League of Denial. And just from the title alone, you can guess. It looks like it's going to go after the NFL's role in the story pretty hard and paint the league in a very unflattering light. Now, until a few weeks ago, it was not just a PBS film. It was a joint project between PBS's Frontline and ESPN. And then ESPN suddenly pulled out, and reportedly that was due to pressure from the NFL. I saw that you ripped ESPN for bailing out. I don't think rip is too strong of a term here.
Oh, I mean, with like big time. I mean, my feeling is this: this is not a football issue. This is a social health issue, and this involves children. All right. So, if you are not willing to fight to protect kids, when you know something might not be good for them, and it's being stated by the experts in the field, I don't respect you a lot. You know, I mean, when
I'm
I met
kind
with them.
of. Go ahead.
No, when I met with them to pitch the film like 3.5, 4 years ago, there wasn't a lot of dialogue about this issue. You know, it certainly wasn't part of the American consciousness. And as we got through the process, as steam started picking up, I was adamant. I was like, listen, this is important. We can help people, we can save people, in addition to the fact that it can be an outstanding film. You can make something that has that has resonance that will make people not want to change the channel, even if it's unpleasant for them, if it's crafted well enough, if you care about the people involved. And I said, so the bonus is that we could help people. And I was point blank told by someone in the film department, that's not our mission. That's not what we're doing here. I was like, yeah, but it could still be a great film. You know, it does. Can you have both? Can you do both? And during the process, at some point, one of the people there just said, listen, as we got closer and closer, you gotta tread lightly when it comes to the NFL. I was told that personally. You know, so I mean, I appreciate the fact that there are articles being written and people on the ESPN side are saying some of the truths that happen. But if you don't put your name to it, like what? You're just gonna you're gonna go to work there. You're gonna feel shame in what you're doing because you're expressing this on the record to people, but you won't put your name to it.
Well, you talked to a lot of media people in the film. You mentioned Mike Silver, he used to be with Yahoo Sports. He's with the NFL Network now. Bob Costas is in the film pretty prominently. Actually, has some pretty critical things to say, given that he works at NBC. I'm not gonna like ask,
Malcolm Gladwell,
right, Malcolm Gladwell. I'm not gonna ask you to necessarily name any names, but did you find as you were working on the reporting in this film that any of the people either you spoke with on camera, off camera, in the media, or try to speak with, that they pulled punches or were circumspect about what they would say on camera because they didn't want to antagonize the NFL because the NFL is essentially their meal ticket?
I personally I didn't pick those people. I knew who was I knew who was going to bring it, and also I knew people that trusted me. I think that Bob Costas is one of the most I mean certainly the most important journalists of our time, not just sports journalists. And I think he makes stands for things that he believes in, and I respect him a lot. And he spoke in a very, very frank manner. For this project, one, because he really believes in what he's saying, and two, because of our long-standing relationship, he trusts me. So it's very difficult to speak on what would be considered a controversial topic if you don't have that built-in relationship or that built-in trust. And one of the things that Mike Silver said, and he's working for NFL Network now, he said that if we talk about a subject that could kill football, we're all scared. And I think that was a great point for him to bring up. And if everybody wasn't scared at the same time, it would be okay. If journalists who were getting screwed over by their parent company because they want to protect their interests, I mean, how can we call ourselves journalists? I did a talk at Boston University last year, where I went to college, and I was speaking to a journalism class, and I'm up there, and Bob Ryan's there too, and he's one of the guys I've always looked up to. But I'm sitting next to Bob, and we're talking to these kids, and it's just like I don't know what to tell them. You're getting a journalism degree. Are they teaching you the same things they taught me? Because if they're teaching you what they taught me, that doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in mainstream media, which is predominant. It doesn't exist. And then you get into the
What is it that
blogosphere.
doesn't exist
Like
specifically?
the basic tenets of journal. I mean, we used to have have two sources for certain things, right?
Right.
There used to be accountability when you were wrong. You used to couldn't print blatant lies about people without some sort of backlash or recourse for that person to call you out and be like, wait a minute, lay your facts down. The news cycle is so quick now. I mean, I'm in that class, and I'm saying to them, I'm like, the professor was asking me, listen, when you had the Bounty Gate audio, was it like burning a hole in your pocket? Did you just how did you like why didn't you just immediately do it? I'm like, because I'm not sitting in a classroom on Twitter at having that be my journalistic integrity. That's not what it's about. I mean, I look at this, and some people say, "Oh, Sean, you're going to lecture on journalism, but you cross the boundaries of it." I cross the boundaries of it because I care about people, and if I'm doing something that I feel is right and is in the best interest of people, yeah, I'll cross those boundaries too. But I'm trying to do it to help people,
Well,
and
let's
I
move to
look at
that
it.
side of your film. Let's talk about that because so much of the film is actually about youth football. So I want there's a here's a contrast that I think you get at somewhat in the film, but I think is even more important again going forward from this settlement at the NFL level. Because we have seen some real positive changes at the NFL level. Again, I don't want to speak to how them being panaceas because they're not, but the NFL and their players' union, they've negotiated reduced contact and practices. There, we talked about there's that proposal for neurologists on the sideline. You're supposed to get clearance from these independent neurologists for a concussed player before you're allowed to return. These are better than not doing anything. Are they enough? I can't say. I have a lot of skepticism about them, but they're better than nothing. But and meanwhile, at college, high school, peewee level, none of these protections are at all standardized. Many, if not most of them, are not available. Most high school and peewee teams, and you know this, they don't even have certified athletic trainers on the sidelines during games or practices. And yet, we also know already that children's brains are still developing. They are biologically and physically more vulnerable to these types of injuries than those of adults. So basically, our largest and most vulnerable football playing population, which by the way isn't even making money in exchange for putting their health on the line, is also the least protected. Now, like I said, your film, you've spent so much time around the youth game. How does what I just described make any sort of social or cultural sense? Why do we allow this?
It's staggering to me. I mean, we've already had three kids die, but then the season has barely just started.
High school
You know,
season, right.
yeah. One of the things that we're trying to do with the United States of Football is we're trying to make it a sort of a call to action, and we're trying to get an idea off the ground and gain some public support, certainly within the medical community and hopefully the National Football League. We've been saying I actually sent this proposal to them. We want to create something called Big Doctors, and it would mirror the Big Brothers, Big Sisters program, where across the country you would have EMTs, you know, trainers, nurses, doctors volunteer their time and adopt a team. Like it is inconceivable to me that you have tackle football being played in practice or in games without adequate medical supervision. And the real tragic part of this to me is that oftentimes it breaks down along economic lines. So in poor communities, you know, I mean, good luck. You're not, you know, if you get a doctor, you know, I mean, I mean, it just doesn't happen very often. You know, it doesn't, it breaks down along racial lines, socioeconomic, and it's not right. You shouldn't have young children playing this game without medical supervision. I mean, there has to be some sort of layer between that player and the coach and his teammates. Someone has to protect these children, because if you're cognitively impaired, one, like, you don't necessarily 100% know you should come out. Yeah, there's something off, but the culture you're around suggests that, you know, you got to toughen up. You got to, you know, get back in there. You know, and the coach isn't medically trained.
Right,
So
it's crazy to it. I mean,
it's
in
nuts.
defense of
It's
these
nuts.
coaches, even the good coaches, I'm not talking about the crazy coaches who are like, you know, tough it up, get in, but like the good coaches who want to actually care for and protect these kids and aren't living out their manhood fantasies through these kids, expecting them to be able to spot a concussion, which is a notoriously difficult injury to diagnose, even for trained professionals, expecting them to do it and they're not trained professionals is absurd.
It puts
It's
too
not
much pressure
fair.
on them.
It does.
It's
It's
yeah,
totally
it's
unfair.
not fair to them. And also, if something happens, then it's on them. That's too much of a burden. I mean, I've met some amazing coaches in the last 3.5 years doing this. Some guys who are definitely close friends of mine now, but I've also seen and who have the best intentions of these kids in mind. But you're right. They don't know that. They can't tell. You know, and you know, then you put in the guys who are crazy, and then it's like a Molotov cocktail. You know, I just feel that these children need to be protected. I mean, that, you know, if they're gonna play at that young an age, it's just not appropriate. And one of the things that we're also trying to talk about and create a talking point in this movie is that, you know, as a result of it, informed consent. You know, when we started out, it was like the idea of informed consent for parents. Parents need to know. Parents need to know. But then, as I saw more parents across the country, it's the reaction at peewee games when you see kids get lit up. It's not too dissimilar from when you're watching, you know, a game on TV with a group of adults, or you're at a game itself when you're seeing adults. I mean, the visceral reaction and excitement is still there. So that level of this is a child oftentimes disappears.
Okay, but
So our idea,
can a
informed
10-year-old, can a 10-year-old kid give informed consent? Can they really understand what the risk is?
probably not, which is the reason why, like, you know, our estimation is you should be mature enough to understand that, rather than have to respond to a cultural pressure and need to play, or parental desire for your kid to play. I mean, I wanted my son to play football. No bones about it, man. I mean, like, my ex-wife was like adamant, no, he's not playing. I didn't even hear her. It was earmuffs time. No, I can't hear you. And we kept training, and then I had to hit a pause. But ultimately, in examining it, I realized I wanted him to play for me. I stopped playing in junior high school. I wanted him to play for me. And once I realized that, and once I saw everything else that was out there, all that time I played with him in the park, all those games of catch, all that stuff, it had a completely different meaning for me. At the time, it was about training him, but it was also us just spending time together as father and son. And then now it's just like, I look at it, it's just this beautiful time for my son and I to bond together. It's about nothing more than that. And you know what? That is completely okay. You
Sure.
don't have to, you don't have to, you don't have to play tackle football to be determined, to have character, and to have all these other things that are associated with the game. That's great. But like I said earlier, if you have that internal thing inside you that wants to succeed or value certain things, you're gonna put forth that effort. And if you're guided in a way that's positive, you're gonna put forth that effort. So I don't the whole idea that you need to play football for this is wrong. There are sometimes these good things can come out as a result of it. But if you apply that same energy towards something else, you're gonna be successful.
Well, you can learn. I mean, you can learn all the good, like, sort of quote unquote character things that you can learn from football: teamwork, discipline, pushing through pain, pushing past obstacles, setting goals, deferring gratification. Those are things you can learn from almost anything in life. You can learn those by being a good student in the classroom, quite honestly. I mean, those are not special magical properties that only come from playing football. If they were, we'd all be screwed as a human race because not that many people on the face of the planet play football. That's one of these things that sometimes I feel like football coaches forget. It's like your sport doesn't have a special dispensation to like molding people. I know you feel like it does, but you've probably just been too involved in the football world to realize it's actually not that unique.
One thing that I think is very, very important is that when you talk about like football coaches, right? One of the things that I've seen in the last 4 years, like up close with this stuff, is that we really need to sort of do a cultural re-examination of what a football coach is and what he is allowed to do. Because I've seen football coaches behave towards children in ways that are just unconscionable. There's one guy that was just so out of, off the chain. I asked him, I said, you know what? Because he's a math teacher too. I said, you know, if you had a student who made a mental mistake, like what you're talking about here, mental mistakes are not excusable. Like, how would you speak to that student? Even in a group situation. And if you spoke to that student the way you just spoke to him yesterday in a group situation, screaming at him, yelling epithets in his face, just like trying to quote unquote motivate him to coach him up, you'd be fired. If you were a baseball coach, you'd be fired. If you were a basketball, track coach, soccer, whatever, if you were any other kind of coach and you behaved that way in front of that kid, in front of his peer group, with that level of intimidation, you would be fired. And what is it that allows us, that gives us latitude for football coaches to come in and get Newt Rockne on, or not Newt, like Vince Lombardi on our 9-year-olds' asses and just be like that's good for them? I don't think so. I don't think that's good for them at all. And I think that there's too many youth coaches who emulate the same verbiage. They use the same phraseology. Oh, lay some hats, son. Get in there. Why didn't I need? I actually saw a coach say to a kid who didn't go as hard because he was a little scared, this 8 or 9 year old, I need you to give me your heart, son. Give me your heart. Are you out of your mind, dude? That's my 9-year-old. You don't get any of him except his hustle.
You think a
I mean,
nine-year-old
seriously.
even understands what he's talking about, honestly?
Well, at 9, I did because I watched NFL films. I did.
But
Like,
I'm
oh,
saying, though,
yeah.
at 9 years old, you don't really know what that even means, even if you
What
watch
you
NFL films.
know is that you're being singled out in front of your peer group and embarrassed. The same
Right.
coach was chastising a kid a few minutes later, for don't dance, don't be dancing in there. That was his way of saying that he wasn't being a man. And I've seen so much of this, and I just go to myself, wow, I mean, These guys are like poor man's Al Bundys, and they're out there and just like they're not bringing positive energy to these kids. I mean, like I said, I've met a bunch of great coaches, but I've seen an incredible amount of coaches who have no business teaching our children a contact sport, and they don't have certifications. I mean, they're getting these concussion training things that they watch these 90-minute videos and stuff. These guys need to be, they need to have tests done if they can actually teach the game properly. They should be interviewed by the parents. They should be interviewed by the parents for their psychological, and I'm totally being serious, for their psychological makeup, without a doubt. You know,
Well,
you can sit down with someone for 30 minutes and figure out where they're coming from for sure.
let me ask you something. Between what you just said about youth coaches and how wildly the, let's call it quality, can vary, and what we've talked about in terms of the physical brain damage risks of the sport, do you have a sense of, like, is there an age where, or should children be allowed to play tackle football at all? Is there a certain age where that should be allowed? Do you have any feelings for that? Some medical experts are now saying let's not have any collision sports for kids under 14, for instance. Other people say no, we need to start sooner so they can learn how to tackle more safely. There's debate about this. Do you have a feeling about it? Do you think there should be a certain age where kids do or don't play tackle football?
Well, I tend to rely on experts for those type of opinions, as I know you do. My personal opinion, I can only give something that I saw that to me that was pretty staggering. And you were sitting right next to me. It was when we did the Aspen Institute, and Dr. Robert Cantu, for people who don't know, very, very well respected in this field. He's written a book, about concussions in kids, and he was saying that he felt he's also the guy in 1986 who wrote the original return to play guidelines for concussions. So he's been in this arena for a long time, and he got up at the Aspen Institute in DC and he said, as he did in his book, that he really strongly believes that children should not be playing the game of tackle football before the high school age because of the unformed brain. And I'd heard that before. And I was like, you know what? I can, that makes sense. That makes sense. I'm not going to tell people what to do, but this is the information I wanted to make the decision with my son, and I appreciate where he's coming from. But when he was talking, literally 3 seats away from him, Scott Hallenbeck, who is the executive director of USA Football, he
Which is
broke out
basically,
into
by the
this.
way, this people know, USA Football is essentially the NFL's youth arm. I was going to call it marketing arm. They do more than just marketing. That wouldn't be totally fair to USA Football. But USA Football is funded by NFL charities. And USA Football is essentially the NFL's youth initiative. And right now, USA Football is highly involved in pushing this heads-up football, which is essentially, in addition to what I think is good, like concussion recognition training, and some coach certification, they are really pushing this idea of heads up safe tackling, where it's like if we just teach proper tackling form, we can quote unquote, and this is a real quote, take the head out of the game. I've written very critically about this. I think the idea you can take the head out of football is ludicrous. I've asked people, if you can take it out, then why are they wearing helmets still? No one has a good answer for that. You can't take the head
That's a
out. You can't take like someone's head off like they're a little Lego figure. Otherwise, and the head's connected to the shoulders. You have to get your shoulders low in order to tackle. You're going to get hit in the head playing football. I guess that's my point for a lot of reasons. Sorry to hijack you there, but let's
No,
go.
it's no problem.
I
I think
wanted to
you
get
have
that into the podcast. I'm already over
yeah.
time, but I had to get that in. But let's go back. Let's go back to what you're saying. So we were at the Aspen Institute. There was a youth football roundtable. Dr. Cantu was talking about no tackle football for children under 14. Scott Hallenbeck, USA Football, is 3 seats over, and
And he broke out into the I mean, a sweat that I haven't seen. I don't know if people listening to this watched the movie Broadcast News, but there was a moment when Albert Brooks had to actually do the news on camera, and he was sweating so profusely. That I mean, that was to see Hallenbeck. I thought it was an optical illusion. I looked over at you and I said, "Are you seeing this?"
it
The
was it
guy
was like
was.
a it was like a one man humidity cone. It just descended upon him. It was unbelievable.
Dude, it's like he came out of the sauna or was like in a water slide or something like that. It was unbelievable. Then he proceeds to get up. And this is before he even spoke. I mean, I get the idea that people get anxious because they have to public speak. It wasn't that. It was him listening to Cantu talk about protecting and saving kids, and him knowing that he had to get up in a second and dispute what this man was saying. So he proceeds to get up and talk about what was his number. 99% of the kids don't want to play flag. They want to do what their heroes do. Well, then we can get back into a boys versus man's game argument here. And, all I know is I saw a dude sweating because if the guy on his right, if what he was saying actually came to fruition, this dude would be looking for another job. And that to me was as telling as you can possibly imagine. I don't need to see a debate or hear a debate. I saw a man sweat with his job on the line, and I was like, wow, okay. That's real.
Yeah,
That is real.
it goes back to those conflicting incentives that we talked about at the start of the podcast. Look, how old was your son when you started the film?
He was 12 when I started, and or almost 12 when I started, and he's 15 now.
He's 15 now. Does he want to play tackle football?
Nope. I just basically gave him the information and let him make his own choice. And that's what I think we need to do as a culture. We need to educate our kids, invest them in the process, and say, listen, this is what can happen to you. Because for me, it wasn't about the catastrophic injuries or the potential death. I understand those numbers are nowhere near as high as they could be. All right. But for me, it's the unknown number. And that's for people who I've talked to about the repetitive head trauma. And the sustained blows over a period of time, what that can do to you in terms of making you a depressed person, your cognitive abilities. I've had parents call me and go, listen, Sean, I'm really glad you're bringing attention to this because my kid was a 3.5 GPA, played 2 years of football, and it's taken him 2 years since to get himself back to where he was.
Yeah.
Kids' brains are being affected. And once my son found that out, he was like, whoa, I don't even, give me a guitar. He plays guitar, he plays baseball. You don't got to play this sport to fulfill my dream, I told them. That's like that, like I don't even dream about that anymore. But all I know is all those passes I was throwing my kid in the park, eventually there was going to be someone on the end of those passes. And I'm glad that I was able to take my own ego out of it. I'm glad I was get information that I can share with other parents. I cannot, say this strongly enough. People need to educate themselves on this issue. They need to educate their children and they need to protect their kids.
Couldn't agree more. Sean Pamplon, we are out of time. In fact, we are well into overtime. It's been great having you. Before we sign off, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you and the film online?
Well, the film you can go to www.theusof.com. That's www. TheUSOF.com. It's got a bunch of theater listings there, which will tell you where it's playing in your markets. The big push, I think, is this coming up, the 6th of September, and we're in, I guess, 141 theaters by then, which is one of the largest openings for a sports doc ever. And I think that if people invest a little bit of time, they can get a lot out of it.
Great. And let me put in a plug here. It's an excellent film. It's definitely worth seeing. I'm not just saying that because I agree with a lot that's in there. I'm saying that because it's a really fine piece of journalism. And no matter where you sort of stand on this issue, or what you think you feel, or what you feel you think, this will challenge you. It's definitely worth seeing. Anyway, that's going to do it for now. Again, my guest today was Sean Pamplon, director of the United States of Football. And in the meantime, for Sports on Earth, I am Patrick Ruby, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.